This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Back to the Future, Part 1.
I says, this is stupid. Those cows have got four legs, they got a mouth, and they can go out there and get their own in the summertime.
That's dairyman Larry Shear talking about his decision to put his cows out to pasture, like in the old days, and how it's paid off for him and his cows.
We thought that if we grew small patches of wheat and we invited our customers to do this, that we could trial wheat and find out which varieties made a good loaf of bread and could survive the weather here.
That's baker Cheryl Maffey. She tells us about her project, The Little Red Hen. It engages local gardeners in growing wheat in their own backyards.
You can drive anything with water, lure up to 20 mills along this river back 200, 150 years ago. Sawmills, grist mills, lathe mills, mills for doing more refined carpentry work and stuff. But the basic power source was the water.
And that's historian Dan Bennett. He'll take us on a tour of an old mill on the Sawmill River in Leverett, Massachusetts, and tell us what it can teach current and future generations. That's all coming up on Sea Change Radio. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today we begin a six-part series called Back to the Future. It'll explore what older ways of living and producing can teach us about adapting to a future that will have to get by with less, much less, use of fossil fuels. We're not talking about going back to the Stone Age or getting rid of innovation, but rather, what can we learn from the old to create new ways of responding to the challenges of climate change and peak oil? Both crises are driving the need to find low-carbon ways of growing our food, getting around, building our homes, and producing other goods and services. Since we first got the idea for the series, the situation has only become more dire. New reports from climate scientists say the Earth is warming faster than previously foreseen, and people around the world and at home are feeling the effects and taking note. On October 24th, just a few days before the inaugural broadcast of the series, the International Day of Climate Action was observed. Its aim was to highlight the most important number on the planet, as its organizers call it, 350. That's a safe upper limit on the concentration of CO2 in our atmosphere many scientists have set. Going above it, and we already have, will likely tip the planet into runaway climate change and destroy civilization as we know it, unless we move fast enough to get CO2 back down. Here are just a few voices from a rally in Northampton, Massachusetts, to mark the International Day of Climate Action. We thought they'd give a fitting introduction to our series. I asked first a college student, then a grandmother, and then the manager of a local food co-op what climate change and that day's action meant to them.
Well, it's a really huge issue to our generation. We just really want all ages to participate in this because this is something that's going to, you know, affect us in the near future and as we get older.
I think about my grandchildren and all the things I love.
I believe it's happening. It means an opportunity for us all to reconnect to what really matters.
Voices from the International Day of Climate Action in Northampton, Massachusetts. So the stakes are high, but so are the benefits. Not just saving our planet for ourselves and our kids, but also more resilient local economies, more satisfying connections with our neighbors, and a higher quality of life. In this series, we'll look at food, transportation, housing, energy, and manufacturing. What we can learn from the past to guide our future. Back to the Future will air monthly on Sea Change Radio. This program series is funded in part by Mass Humanities. We start out with the first of two episodes about food. We'll hear from a farmer, a baker, and a historian helping to restore old mills in Leverett, Massachusetts. Mills that in their time ground grain and sawed logs for, among other things, barns and farmhouses. Larry Shearer is a dairy farmer in Colerain, Massachusetts. I spoke to him in spring of 2007. Although he's past retirement age, he's not retired, as he told me. Just slow down. He helps manage the Colerain Dairy with his sons.
We're standing here, and we've got in front of us a batch of 18, or actually the 20 heifers there, that will be having their calves in about 3 months. They have had no grain for about 16 months.
The Colerain Dairy has been certified organic since 2007. But long before that, Larry Shearer decided to do dairying in the old style by pasturing his cows instead of feeding them grain like most modern dairy farmers do. He hasn't regretted the decision to dairy in the old-fashioned way.
I will stack them up against any group of heifers that any conventional farmer has raised. They are in good condition. They are healthy. The vet has not seen them once. We had absolutely no problem getting them bred. They're all safe with calf. It's by utilizing pasture and homegrown hay on land that has been farmed organically.
Once upon a time, Shearer was in the forefront of doing things the newfangled way. In 1964, he built the first freestanding milking stall facility in Massachusetts, where his cows stayed inside all year round.
That was total confinement. The animals were in year round. We hauled all the feed to them, even in the summertime. And then about 1983, I was hauling feed to them in the middle of the summer. And it had rained a lot, and I was having all kinds of problems getting it to them. And I says, this is stupid, that those cows have got four legs, they got a mouth, and they can go out there and get their own in the summertime. So we started grazing and found out that it worked fairly well. And we kind of concentrated on improving the grazing methods that we were using and got it to what we now call managed intensive grazing. Like now, we move the milking cows, every 12 hours onto a new piece of pasture.
Pasturing cows helps keep the cost down of going organic, since the cost of organic grain is about double the price of conventional grain. But Shearer can stay organic because he can grow his own feed right out in the hayfield.
It has cost us very little to keep these heifers for this year. We have been actually organically farming all our hay fields and our pastures for about 8 years. Therefore, we put up organic feed. We have fed them basically no grain, so we had no out-of-pocket cost.
Cows are meant to eat grass, not grain. Getting them off grain keeps them healthier, and that means less antibiotics.
We have been farming now for roughly 10 years with using a very minimal amount of antibiotics because our cows are healthy. They've been out on pasture. They've been fed mostly roughage. We are not pushing them for high production.
Frolicking in the fields is healthy for the cows too.
We found that when they're outdoors in the summertime, exercising in the sun, we have no problems at all. In the 17 years that we've been doing this, I think we've lost just two calves.
Organic milk brings a premium price. Back when we talked with Shearer in 2007, organic brought about double the price of conventional milk. It's come down a bit since then, but it still commands a much higher price. Shearer says with his low-cost, high-value method of dairying, the economics are good.
It costs you roughly half as much to maintain each cow because we're feeding very little supplemental feed that we have to purchase. Our vet bill is probably a quarter to a tenth of what the conventionals are. Our electric bill is down. Our fuel bill is down. No fertilizer expenses. And if you're getting twice as much money, and your expenses are half as much, you're better off.
Larry Shearer says farming this way has given him a higher quality of life, more time for his family, and less stress. I asked him if his kind of dairy farming had also made the cows happier.
Well, you just got to look at these animals out here. Don't they look contented? And when you got healthy animals, you feel better.
And with that, the heifers of the Coleraine Dairy were set loose out to pasture.
Cow nature.
Yeah,
you ever seen a buffalo stampede? That's what they do.
And it's the only time all season they'll do it. It's their first time out.
Next up, wheat growing comes back to Western Massachusetts. You're listening to Sea Change Radio's first episode of a six-part series, Back to the Future. The Connecticut River Valley used to be the breadbasket of the nation back in colonial times. Hardy wheat varieties that could withstand the winters and the wet of the Northeast were grown around here. Cheryl Maffey is co-owner of Hungry Ghost Bakery in Northampton, Massachusetts. She runs an innovative project that's enlisting local residents in growing New England-friendly wheat varieties in their backyard gardens. It's called Little Red Hen.
Well, we should also start to call it the Little Red Hen and Big Roosters because we've got some farmers involved in our project.
Maffey came into our studio recently to talk about the project, which started in the spring of 2008. I asked Maffey why she started it.
It was an idea to get people aware of the issues around having local wheat. So I need to back it up a few years prior to that. We've had Hungry Ghost Bread in Northampton since 2004, so we're in our sixth year now. And right from the get-go, our organic flour was labeled organic, but its carbon footprint was huge. Grown in North Dakota, shipped to North Carolina, where it was milled, trucked to a distributor in New Hampshire until it made it to us. So, giant footprint. We didn't like that. And then, probably 3 years ago, the price of an organic bag of flour tripled to nearly $60.
And does that reflect the price of oil going up? Is that why?
Well, there's a number of reasons why that happened. Certainly the price of oil and transportation was a big cause of it, but also that crops were being displaced for fuel, such as soybeans and corn. So farmers were receiving a subsidy not to grow certain grains and certain crops, wheat being one of them. That depleted the stock and the price went up. Currently, the majority of our flour comes out of Quebec. And when we realized that we could get flour from Quebec, we said, wait a minute, it's a little colder there. It might even be a little wetter there, or it's the same climate. Why can't we grow wheat here?
Talk a little bit about that. This area, in fact, that we're in, the Connecticut River Valley of Massachusetts, was at one time a great wheat growing area, the breadbasket of the nation, is that correct?
That's true. In 1602, it was the first place in the United States where wheat was grown.
Or at least what would be the United States.
Exactly. So one of the varieties, Red Llamas, is an older variety that can still be grown here. And it's true that more modern varieties of wheat need to be grown in a dry climate that is hotter than it gets here in the summer, such as the Plain States. So modern wheat has been bred to be grown in large quantities and harvested by huge combines. It's centralized there.
But this project was to grow more local wheat. So tell us how this is going, the Little Red Hen and the Big Rooster. First, you got folks engaged who weren't even farmers. Is that right?
That's correct. Well, we realized that there was going to be a large investment for farmers, not only in equipment, but in trial and error of figuring out what varieties of wheat to grow. So we thought that if we grew small patches of wheat and we invited our customers to do this, that we could trial wheat and find out which varieties made a good loaf of bread and could survive the weather here. So we started with some great educated guesses of three different varieties, and 100 customers last spring grew these three different varieties of wheat. And we got anything from envelopes full of seeds to big shopping bags full of seeds, and it looked pretty great. And I guess some farmers got really encouraged by that.
So what varieties and what did you find?
Well, we grew spring varieties, hard red spring wheat. Those three varieties grew well, but weeds were a huge issue. And that taught us quite a lot. I mean, one plot even had a bear decide to make it a nice little bed. So that took out that crop. But what we realized...
A different kind of weed.
Definitely a different kind of weed. What we realized is that we really needed to be dealing, for the most part, with wheat that's planted in the fall, begins to grow, and then winters over, and ideally is harvested sometime in the beginning of July. So we began to experiment in larger quantities with that. People took some of that home, and it's great. And I think everybody should keep growing their own wheat and put in their blender or get a small hand-cranked mill and just try making a loaf of bread. It's just good to do.
Hand-cranked mills are okay for home use, but what about commercial mills? As we'll hear later, water-driven mills used to be used for grinding grain. Maffey's project experimented with a bicycle-driven mill, but that wasn't very practical.
Now we have an electric mill. We plug it in and it works, and that's great. Prior to that, we had this little hand crank mill that one might use at home, and they're very practical for home. But when you're talking about doing a mix for 60 loaves of bread, you're going to be there for a really long time, as we were. And so we needed
bicycle,
to do that.
A bicycle may not be the best way.
It may not be the most efficient way. But, you know, I do know that David Fisher at Natural Roots Farm was talking about possibly getting a horse-powered mill. And there are horse-powered mills. I know Jack Laser up in Vermont at Butterworks. He's been growing wheat for many, many years, and he works off of horsepower as well. So there are definitely ways to adapt and not use electricity to mill.
And of course, electricity doesn't have to be fossil fuel driven.
Exactly.
As we are thinking about using old technologies in new ways, as we face a lower carbon future, how do you see the work you're doing with Little Red Hen and Big Rooster fitting into this idea of a lower carbon footprint?
Well, certainly if it's grown locally, you're not paying for the transportation for it to come thousands of miles across the country. And now, of course, it's 5 hours away in Montreal, and that's significantly less. But there, as we discovered this summer with four farmers growing a total of about 8 acres of spelt and rye and local wheat, and then 18 acres of pastry flour, which is a little more conducive to this area, with the past summer and spring of incredible wet weather that we had, tobaccos, lost tomatoes, and potatoes, the wheat was harvested beautifully, and we're making bread out of it. As I speak right now, there's some bread being mixed and it'll be baked tomorrow, and there it will be. And every week there's some local bread from the wheat of that the farmers have grown. And that is, it's incredible to be able to go to your farmer, pick up your berries and bring them back to the bakery. And it's just, why wouldn't we want to have a local food system?
Although Little Red Hen is beginning to source more of its wheat from local farmers, the project is still signing up gardeners.
We do still want to encourage people to come by the bakery. We have seeds. It's just getting past time when you should put it in the ground for fall planting. But in the spring, we will have some AC Berry, which is a spring wheat available. And then, of course, next fall, we are absolutely a resource where people who want to come and grow a small plot of their own wheat, and they can come by and get some wheat for us from us.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
Sure.
If you think you want to grow some wheat in your own backyard, or just taste some of Hungry Ghost's delicious bread made from local wheat, you'll find the bakery at 62 State Street in Northampton, Massachusetts. And now for our last segment on this episode of our series, Back to the Future.
Well, it's a pretty open-faced building so that logs can be rolled into it from up the hill. They put on this carriage. This is one of the longest carriages in the Northeast. During the Second World War, it was used to cut oak keels for naval vessels because it was long. There aren't too many beds this long anywhere.
We're standing with local historian Dan Bennett in a post and beam sawmill in North Leverett, Massachusetts. It's located on the fittingly named Sawmill River near Moore's Corner. Asa Moore was a soldier in the Revolutionary War and came to Leverett as a millwright. Around 250 years ago, he built the original mill on this site and also the grist mill further upstream, which is now a private residence. But this sawmill was in use up until the 1970s. The current building is about 100 years old, and it's now being restored. There's a circular saw blade now, but the logs used to be sawn by two men.
The circular blade was invented, they say, by a Quaker lady sitting at the spinning wheel, looking out the window, seeing the up and down blades. When people cut originally, they dug a hole or did it on the edge of a slope, and you had two men drawing a straight blade up and down through the log, and the guy in the bottom was called the pitman, and he pulled the blade up and down this way, and the other guy up on top did it this way. When they got the water power, they harnessed the blade to, and they called the gear at the bottom the pitman because it was doing exactly what the guy had been doing. But that went out in the 1840s with the invention of the circular blade. You can drive anything with water. There were up to 20 mills along this river back 200, 150 years ago. Sawmills, grist mills, lathe mills, mills for doing more refined carpentry work and stuff. But the basic power source was the water. If we go over by the window, you can see the dam and what it can do for you. And also we can go downstairs and the turbine that draws the water in and drives the belts still down there.
Let's do that.
The first sawmill on the river was put up downriver in what's now Montague. Back then, this whole area, including Montague, Leverett, Wendell, was called Swamp Field. And if you can look around, there's a lot of swamp. And the first mill was deeded down there in 1716, 2 years before Sunderland was incorporated. This has been the sawmill active zone for a long time. Though, as I say, not everybody ran a sawmill. A lot of people used the water power for gristing.
Instead of a wheel, a turbine drove this mill, built in the late 1800s.
Let's go in and see if we can figure out how to get a look at the turbine, because it's moved from wheel to turbine. But it's all 19th century technology.
And so this is pre-electric?
Oh, yeah. The electricity didn't come to this town until the 1930s, especially this end of town. With the New Deal, and the rural electrification.
So were people actually using this then without electrical power?
No electricity here.
So now if it were to be used again, you know, without electricity, what kinds of modifications do you think would be useful?
Well, I think the basics are here. So you can shift over, you can do that. And also in Turner's, there's still the old canal system and the turbines and that. You can generate electricity off of that.
So you would actually generate electricity to run this?
Well, you could generate enough electricity to maybe power a few local residences, yeah. But I noticed over here, we can't see it so clearly now because the water's flowing. But on the other end of the dam, there was another wheel.
And we're looking through the window here.
Across the dam. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, he had some kind of a blacksmithing thing because you had to make your own parts. You couldn't just sort of, you know, mail to Detroit or something. There was some of that, but basically a local blacksmithing industry grew up with the milling, and they went hand in hand. Where we started at the schoolhouse, that place across the street, there's a grist mill that survives, and then beside it, a machine shop. Because you've got to have constant working of the parts, because you got to be able to repair them yourself.
So we're walking now to the turbine?
Yeah, with the power source, what drives all these wheels. See, to drive the saw upstairs, well, those wheels, see them?
Now, one question that comes to mind is, the machinery's here, but the knowledge of how to use it is not.
Well, among the 80-plus-year-olds who worked here as children, it's still around. We have a decade to appropriate that knowledge before it's too late.
Here we have, you say, a decade. We also probably have a decade to make some major changes. You know, peak oil is certainly coming within the decade.
I know. Well, when I was still an academic, I forget the guy's name, was a British economist who wrote a book called Small is Beautiful.
Oh, Schumacher.
Oh, yeah, okay. And I've been working now in this area for over 30 years, and I really like the idea of a local, small-scale industrial base. I think that's what we have to go to. It won't solve all problems, but locally it'll be desirable, I think.
Dan Bennett took me over to a large opening right next to the waterfall that powered the mill.
The way it works, you let your mill pond fill, and you schedule when you're going to cut, and then you saw down the mill pond. That is, you draw the water through, and you get ahead of the actual supply when you drive in one of these places. So you can't drive it every day. You let your mill pond build up. Now, along this river, there were, I don't know, at least 10 mill ponds, maybe more, some of which you can still see, like this one. So they had to coordinate. They had to get it so that you weren't taking someone else's water upstream. So they had to agree on a staggered schedule. There had to be a communal sharing of the water.
A community working together. Another great idea from the past we'll need in making a transition to a low-carbon future. An idea historians like Dan Bennett are helping to preserve. You've been listening to the first episode in our Sea Change series, Back to the Future. This program series is funded in part by Mass Humanities, which receives support from the Massachusetts Cultural Council and is an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Thanks for listening to Sea Change Radio. This week's show was produced by Francesca Rhiannon.
Our theme music is by Sanford Lewis.
Check out seachange.net. That's the letter C, then change.net, to download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Tune in next week for more on the shift to sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon.